everyone, and welcome to Myth in the Mojave, a weekly half hour of storytelling and conversation about mythology and why it's important to our lives today. I'm your personal mythologist, Catherine Svela. I live in Joshua Tree, and I'm pleased to bring this program to the high desert and beyond here on Radio Free Joshua Tree. The Hopis have a proverb. They say, "He who tells the stories rules the world." And that power of stories to create our world is what I want to talk about today. I've been thinking about that a lot as part of my reaction to the murder of 9 people at Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in South Carolina. As I'm sure you all know, a young white man, Dylan Storm Roof, killed them after sitting with them for about an hour as part of their Bible study. It seems like absolutely nuts. And there are 2 questions that come to the forefront for me. You know, one is, why did it happen? And then also, what can we do to prevent racial violence and bridge the divide to heal what John Stewart called the gaping racial wound in our country? Now, the murders were clearly inspired by racial hatred. Roof's sentiments have been very easy to discover, and I guess according to news reports, he believes that blacks are taking over the world and someone has to do something about it for the white race, so on and so forth. I fervently hope that this country can have an honest, deep conversation about our legacy of racism and violence and the ways that our society is structured to keep white people on top. That conversation is going to take courage, and it's going to take imagination. It's going to take courage because we've got to face the ugliness and the brutality and the injustice that we perpetrate on each other. And we've got to shed this sort of pathological innocence that leads us to all kind of walking around going, "Who me? Who me? Oh, not me, not me. I wouldn't." Yeah, right. And it's going to take imagination because the roots of our racial divide are buried in the stories that we tell ourselves and the mythologies that are unconsciously guiding us. It's also going to take imagination because compassion and empathy, the ability to put yourself in another person's shoes, is an act of imagination. There are 2 ways that we get to know somebody else, 2 ways we can get into somebody else's head. One of them is that we have similar experiences and we see those parallels. The other is that we can imagine it. And that's by far the superior way to do it. Now, I'm not an expert on white supremacist manifestos or on all of the many sociological and psychological theories that are floating around about oppression and violence and the disaffected and or paranoid members of our society. But I do know why Roof was capable of killing innocent people in cold blood. He could do it because he believes in a world of us against them. And he has a view of the other that is so threatening and alien to him that killing them is necessary and acceptable. That us versus them paradigm is a very old one. The recorded history of our species is pockmarked, and in some ages and places, like the American Civil War, for example, is defined by the violent struggle between groups of people who are convinced that they have to take sides to survive, and the cruel exploitation of those who are deemed other. the other is believed to be so different, so evil, so inferior, that the normal social and moral laws just don't apply. Race is one way that we can identify and define the other, but it's not the only one. We use gender, we use religious beliefs, class, sexual preferences, political ideologies. This is one of the reasons why we can't have an honest debate in this country anymore. Because if we disagree, if we have different ideas about healthcare, for example, then we're on opposite sides with a fervency that is hateful. The fear and the hate that these definitions and divisions can create is patently insane to anybody who doesn't live in the story of us and them that creates it. But it's completely reasonable if you do. Within the confines of your story, you're always the one who's right. So how do we break that down? Well, that's what I want to talk about in this program today. You know, the habit of dividing the world in this fashion starts in early childhood with the realization of self. Understanding that I am me and you are you is a crucial step in the development of our consciousness, our self-consciousness. When you become aware of yourself as a person separate from your mom and dad, for example, then you also realize that mom and dad are distinct beings. The same goes for the family dog, the squirrel in the tree, and the tree. Now, I realize that what I'm saying is very basic common knowledge, but if we want to understand how relationships between people get so distorted that they lead to the murder of 9 innocent people during Bible study, then I think we have to go back to the beginning. That process, this process, from the point of recognizing me and you, and it's a process that each of us is engaged in for the rest of our lives, then becomes one of identification, definition, connection, and value. That self-other dualism expands to include the us-them story, the us-them formulation. And this is where the individual and the society meet. It's where the influences of our mythologies, of our shared cultural narratives, become very apparent. Once we see ourselves as separate, we start looking for ways to connect, for community, for acceptance, for love. We make friends. We're part of groups. We see similarities and differences between self and other, and we learn to appreciate them, embrace them, dissolve them, or distrust them. This is a psychological process that we all go through, and for many of us, it's a crucial social and spiritual task. The ultimate understanding and state of being, and maybe you, like me, are groping your way towards this, is living in oneness. Jesus said, "Love your neighbor as yourself." In the East, we hear, "Thou art that." Our myths tell us who we are. And because human beings are social creatures, this also means that who we are is who are you. The distinctions that we make and the separations that we feel between ourselves and other people, between ourselves and the divine, the world, all of it is an illusion that we can see through, and all of it is a function of our mythologies, our stories. I want to pause here for a moment to clarify my use of these terms, myth and mythology, because we get all bollocksed up in that because we use the word myth to talk about something that's not true. And myths are true, but they are existential truths. They tell us things about life, about the experience of being human. And that changes. It's not absolute. Myths and mythologies are often equated with religious beliefs about the divine, about God or gods and goddesses. And those narratives are a core component of mythology. Our questions, our concepts and experience of the mysteries of the cosmos, the origin of the world, the influence of the invisible and non-material on our lives, and the connection between life and death are of the utmost importance to us. And it seems like it has been from the beginning, because we look at the very first marks that human beings have left behind that we have found, their artifacts and their stories. You know, I think of Stonehenge and the cave paintings, figurines in burial sites, the pyramids, and stories like the Sumerian myth of Gilgamesh, which is at least 4,000 years old, that I told on this program. Those all are evidence of our exploration of these mysteries, mysteries of the cosmos and the lived experience of being here. Now, all of those examples I gave are considered to be part of classical mythology, myths from the past. But we are still making myths. We are still living, and we are still engaged with those same mysteries. And those mysteries go beyond our notions of the sacred, especially as we live in societies that have become increasingly secular. The words myth and the notion of myth-making should properly be used to describe our secular belief systems and theories and speculations, as well as our continued interpretations of religion and classical mythology. You might read about or talk about the myth of progress, for example. The belief that progress, defined as an increased reliance on technology and consuming more stuff, you know, is inevitable and good. That's a secular mythology, and it's a myth because it's an expression of value. What's good? What's inevitable? Our myths are shared narratives that contain our cultural assumptions and our values. We inherit these, and our consciousness is shaped by them. And as we go through life, we embroider them, if you will, with our personal stories, with the stories that we create about the events and the details of our experience that feel significant, you know, and meaningful to us. These myths and stories create our reality. They are reality. They are the world that we live in. They tell us what is true. Back to that Hopi proverb again. He who tells the stories rules the world. They're that powerful. Now, the power of myth has led some people to say that we have to do away with it. The driving force between modernism, starting with the Enlightenment, science, humanism, materialism, the critiques of religion that came along with that, were all an attempt to replace mythology, understood as superstition and a handful of just distorted and illogical and ultimately destructive ideas with objective reason and truth. Now, we do have lots of problems with mythologies, what Campbell called tribal mythologies, mythologies of the chosen people. You know, because when you have a story that gives you identity and reinforces identity, it's part of that us-them paradigm I was talking about. Shared stories reinforce community. If you know and accept the story, then you're in the circle. And if you don't, you're not. You know, if you listen to the language in the debate about the continued use of the Confederate flag, you're going to hear this language of identity. People talking about how it represents who we are, our history. It honors those who died. which means our heroes, those who made a sacrifice that is still meaningful to us. And of course, on the flip side, what's hidden underneath that is the continued acceptance of what that sacrifice was for, the racism. Our myths can divide us. Historically, our myths have divided us because they have been shared among contained communities. But as we move out of that, as the world becomes smaller, as our contact with the other in a myriad of forms, different faces, different styles, different beliefs, different everything, as the diversity of humanity becomes more and more apparent to more and more of us on a daily basis, our stories can bring us together. Creation myths, you know, I've been talking about beginnings here and by going back to the beginnings of our self-consciousness. Creation myths, wide variety of creation myths. But if you look at how they all start, what you see is they are all stories about human beings emerging from the same place. In that first action, before we get separated out into the nine tribes, or the black and the white, or the those who speak this language and those who speak that language, we are all dirt, clay, breath, the first word or note of a song. The dust from the first star in an exploding galaxy, light years from this planet. But we forget that part. We all come from the same source. According to our stories, we are manifestations of the infinite, fated to die, leaving our stories behind. So as I said a moment ago, a driving force behind modernism, the modern paradigm, was getting rid of mythology, replacing mythology and imagination with objective reason and truth. But this is impossible. And what's happened instead is that our myth-making, the way that we are constantly interpreting and creating reality, that has, we become blind to that. Our stories have gone underground. You know, we think of facts. We think that facts equal truth. But as the physicist David Bohm observed, the root meaning of the word fact is that which has been made. Truth depends on context. When you take our facts, that which has been made, and you filter them through our attitudes about what is valuable, you get myth. Human consciousness is fundamentally imaginative. Human beings are myth makers. We can't stop making and living through mythologies. We can, however, become conscious that that is what we are doing. We can start taking responsibility for our beliefs as choices, choices that we are making among stories, not absolute truths. And I think that this is the unique challenge of our time, the key to any evolution in consciousness and culture, as well as the survival of our species, that we stay with the mystery. Failing to see our own myths as myths, we consider all other myths, the beliefs and values of other people, to be false. And that leads to fundamentalism. That leads to a fatal, as we can see, confusion about belief and attitude and absolute truth. So how do you do that? How do we see through our beliefs and our certain assumptions to the myths that give rise to them? Well, you do it by working with stories. When you work with story, when you put yourself in story, like we do here on Myth in the Mojave, you start to get it, that the reality of story is reality. And when you exercise your imagination in the context of story, you start to realize that Imagination isn't just one of those things that we do. Imagination is what we're always doing. Imagination is not fantasy. Imagination is that mediator, that function of human consciousness that allows us to create order and find meaning in what's out there. This is our great challenge and our opportunity as this world gets smaller, to respect the differences, to be tolerant, to celebrate and support what we share, the needs of the body most certainly, also the need for love, for the freedom to develop our gifts and to be in community. So how do we understand other people, get into their heads? Empathy, I said. Empathy, imagination. And one way to develop that is the open-minded exploration of myths and stories of the people that you see as being different from you. This is why working with stories is so important. Claude Levi Strauss said that a myth is good to think with. And Wendy Doniger, another mythologist, adds that we can learn to feel with them, too. Studying the stories and the myths of other people opens you up to the experience and the reality and truth of those who appear different. But obviously, some of our myths, some of the stories that we're passing around are destructive. Now, what I'm saying, first and foremost, is that it's being unconscious about your myths that is problem number one. But as we become conscious, then, you might ask, well, what is a good mythology? What is a useful mythology? How do we create stories or foster stories that bring us together? Well, I would say that we look at a story and we go, how does this help us live? What kind of world does it create? Does it affirm life? Does it respect difference and recognize commonalities? You know, Joseph Campbell was a critic of tribal mythologies. And when Armstrong walked on the moon and brought back that amazing picture of planet Earth, you've all seen it, that photo that shows Earth, our beautiful blue planet hanging out there. He imagined that that image might be the catalyst for a mythology, a new mythology, a mythology that included all of us, all beings on planet Earth as members of one community. I love that idea because we do need our myths. Barry Lopez says sometimes a person needs a story more than food. And in that, he's talking about the positive myths and stories that provide us with identity, with purpose, and meaning. A good myth tells you why and how to go on. But to be sustained and not controlled, not victimized, and ultimately dehumanized by your stories, you have to be conscious of your story as a story. Now, I've been telling you a story about beginnings today, about the beginnings of self-consciousness and the power of myth. And along the way, I evoked a couple of creation myths. So I want to close this program with a short creation story from the Yoruban tradition that I just love because I think it's beautiful and funny and human. And I have a poem here too that echoes the story that I want to share. So the story is about Obatala and Ishu, the trickster. And these are two gods in the Yoruban pantheon. And Obatala is, he's a very cool and white and pure god. And he made human beings. So according to this story, one day the god Obatala was sitting in the forest and he was making human beings out of clay. And Ishu, the trickster, was walking along, and he found him, and he stopped to visit with Obatala. And Ishu had a bottle of palm wine with him, which he opened, and he offered Obatala a drink. Now, Obatala is a very pure spirit and a righteous god, but he does like a little wine, and so he agreed to have a drink. And it was a very hot day, and the two of them sat together for a while, and Ishu got Obatala drunk. Now, this whole time, though, that they're talking and drinking this bottle of wine, Obatala is continuing to make human beings. But as he got inebriated, his sense of proportion and everything else started getting a little wonky. And the god made cripples and albinos and some other less than perfect human beings that afternoon. And this is how diversity came into the world. Now I want to follow that with this poem called Obatala, Grant Me the Gift of Your Error. And it's by Pius Adesanami from Words Bigger Than the Mouth. Obatala, grant me the gift of your error. Excess of palm wine is the beginning of art. I covet not your gold chain, and my tongue does not water for the liver of your sand-scattering hen. Grant me only the gift of your error. Weary after a long day of molding perfect men, drained after a long day of sculpting perfect women, you punctured the neck of a palm tree. Alas, your throat imbibed this foaming liquid in excess, the same excess that made Ogun flood the land with an ocean of blood, gushing from the headless bodies of subjects he swore to defend. Ah, Obatala, you who own the whiteness of this liquid, is this you? This staggering silhouette, slave to the whims of foam? Palm wine drove your creative hands from the uniformity of shapes to a cacophony of forms. Surely, excess of palm wine is the beginning of art. I salute the cripple. I salute the albino. I salute the obese. I salute the anorexic, the giant, the dwarf. I salute the one-legged man and the one-handed woman, the born blind, the born deaf, the born mute, the born blind, deaf, and mute. I salute the black man. I salute the white man. I salute the brown man. I salute the yellow man. I salute the mulatto. I salute you all, imperfect products of a god's error of inebriation. Icons of art's plenitude to a poet's admiring eyes. Ah, Obatala, grant me the gift of your error, that my verse may escape the tyranny of uniformity. Grant me the gift of your error that I may rhyme some, free others. Grant me the gift of your error that my art may sing the beauty of difference. Grant me the gift of your error that my art may be rainbow. At the outset, I said that I don't know the detail of Root's beliefs. I don't know his whole story. But the power of a specific myth is not as important to realize as the power of myth-making itself. Our challenge, our revision, the form of the life-affirming attitudes and stories that will bring us together is in our myths. That's it for me, Catherine Savela, and Myth in the Mojave for this week. I hope you'll tune in next week. And in the meantime, happy myth making, and keep the mystery in your life alive.